This episode is brought to you by the Colorado Northwestern Community College. Join them for 2 weeks digging up dinosaur bones from the Jurassic period in Northwest Colorado this summer. For details, go to cncc.edu/dinodig. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
And today in our 401st episode, we have an interview with Susanna Maitment, the Stegosaur and Stegosaurus expert.
Mm-hmm. It's a good one.
And we have Dinosaur of the Day, Mercury Ceratops. I've also got a fun fact about stegosaurs.
Ooh.
Specifically stegosaurs. But before we get into all of that, we want to thank some of our patrons for keeping our podcast running. And this week we'd like to thank Ewan, Wyatt, Trent Carbajal, Stefan, Mycoraptor, Quinn Pomeroy, Sarasaurus Rex, Jeff, Bradley, and Ranger Chris from Dino for Hire.
Thank you so much for being part of our community and for listening to us for the last 401 episodes.
I can't believe some people have actually done that. That's a lot.
Yeah. Well, we made them.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Doesn't feel like it's been that many. So now we're going to get into our interview with Susanna Maitment. But as always, we have an extended version for our patrons. So if you are a patron, that means that you get a custom RSS feed, which includes extended interviews. So you might want to listen to that there. So we're joined this week by Susanna Maitment, who's a principal researcher and curator of the archosaurs at the Natural History Museum in London. She's published more than 50 scientific papers and is an expert on stegosaurs. Her research includes systematics, anatomy, and taxonomy of ornithischians, the geological context of dinosaur evolution, and dinosaur biodiversity. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess up first is, how did you get your start working on or with stegosaurs?
Actually, that's not a super interesting story, to be honest with you. Often when you're trying to get into doing a PhD in vertebrate paleontology or in dinosaurs, at least in the UK, where I did my PhD, then you tend to apply for projects. So supervisors will email or will have a list of projects, they'll advertise a list of projects, and you can go around and, you know, apply for these different projects. And there was this really cool project advertised that was on the early evolution of the ornithischian dinosaurs at the University of Cambridge. And I thought that sounded like a really, really cool project. So I thought I'd go and apply for that one. And I got asked to go to interview, and I got there at interview. And the supervisor, who was a guy called Dave Norman, who's spent his career working on iguanodontians, some of your listeners might be familiar with him. As soon as I walked in the room, he said, oh, that PhD is not available anymore. I've given it to a chap in the year above. Richard Butler's got it now. So, you can't do that one. So I sort of was like, oh, why am I here then? I don't know. Okay. He interviewed me anyway. So I was like, all right, grand. I had no idea what was going on. I was completely at a loss. And after I got home and after a couple of weeks, he emailed me and said, how would you like to work on stegosaurs? That one isn't available, but would you like to do a project on stegosaurs? They really need looking at, and nobody's working on them, and nobody's really done anything with them ever. So, you know, in a modern context. So I think that would be a good project. So I was like, yeah, sure, that sounds great. You know, I had a blow up stegosaur when I was a kid. I had a stegosaur money box, and I thought, well, you know, that sounds fab. So I started working. So I fell into it. It was purely accidental.
Nice. Yeah, stegosaurs are really good for toys. I had a stegosaur hat that was my favorite when I was a kid.
I've seen this really cool thing. People keep sending me a picture of it on Twitter, which is like a tortilla holder. So it's a stegosaur it's like a bowl, but it doesn't have the back plates. And then you stack the tortillas in it like it's plates. It's really cool. I'm going to get one of those.
That is pretty great.
That is.
Sabrina has a little stegosaur purse too.
Oh yeah.
Oh nice.
Yeah. That just lovely shapes they make.
It is nice, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So what was the first stegosaur you worked on in that project, or was it just stegosaurs generally?
Well, I did. I worked on all of the stegosaurs, really. I mean, I think I saw virtually every specimen that there is worldwide. There's a couple I didn't see in private collections, and there's a couple in China that I couldn't get my hands on. Mm. I did visit China, went to lots of different museums in China, but some of them just were not available at the time to work on. But the first one I worked on, actually, amazingly, I think, there are two stegosaurs known from the UK. And actually, the first stegosaur ever found was found in 1875 in Swindon, which is a very unremarkable town in the south of England. And so when I tell British audiences this, they always crack up because the idea that you would find a stegosaur in Swindon is totally weird. But anyway, it was found in Swindon in 1875, and it was described by Richard Owen, who's the founder of the Natural History Museum, where I now work. And so that was the first specimen that I really worked on. And it probably still is my favourite specimen. It's massive. It's also, I think, the biggest stegosaur from anywhere in the world. Mm. So, yeah, bigger than the biggest stegosauruses. So, yeah, but I have worked on them all. I worked on them in China. The African stegosaurs are mostly in Germany, actually. So I worked on those there. I've worked on the US ones. So all around the world.
Wow. Awesome. What's the genus of that really big one?
Oh, I didn't say. It's called Dasentrurus.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I should have known. I didn't realize it was bigger than Stegosaurus, though. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's huge. I know. It's also because we don't have a mounted skeleton. We've only got one specimen of it, and we don't have a mounted skeleton. It's actually a slab. It's part of the skeleton is still in the slab, and it is on display in the Natural History Museum, but people just walk past it because it's kind of unremarkable, you know. And it's in the same hall that we have all these amazing, complete, articulated marine reptiles, the ichthyosaurs and the plesiosaurs, and they're beautiful and spectacular. And then on the other wall, there's just this kind of stegosaur, and it's just in this case, and nobody notices it. But it's huge if you go look at it.
I don't know if we noticed.
I'm trying to remember if we noticed.
Because we sort of glazed through the... There's the dinosaur hall, which is just like chock full of a million dinosaurs. So we very closely looked around to make sure we weren't missing anything in there. But I think we pretty quickly went through the marine reptile one.
We did that move.
Yeah. Well, actually, at the museum, the interesting thing is I think some of our best... Well, actually, pretty much all of the best specimens that are on display are not on display in the dinosaur gallery. The dinosaur gallery is about 30 or 40 years old now, and we are going to redevelop it fairly soon, actually. But it has, you know, it's of its time. So it has a lot about the paleobiology of dinosaurs in. It's got lots of buttons you can press and levers you can pull, which I think was, you know, very much the fashion in the 80s for museum displays. It's probably a bit less so now. And it's got lots and lots of casts of complete dinosaurs. But actually, the real material that's on display, some of our really, really good specimens are in other parts of the museum. So.
That's true. Yeah, like there's the Mantellosaurus, I want to say, like when you go in sort of off in a corner as well.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So I did a project a couple of years ago. So that's actually the holotype of Mantellosaurus. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really historically significant specimen. And it's one of the most complete dinosaurs ever found in the UK. It was inaccessible to researchers for a really long time because it was actually hanging from the ceiling of the dinosaur.
Oh, it was one of those.
So, yeah. And then they took it down and they put it in the nook in the central hall when they redeveloped that area in a glass box, which is a beautiful display item, but it's complete. Again, we can't get into it because it's in a glass box. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of years ago, we did a project where we decided to try to 3D scan the whole thing and describe the whole thing. So the public engagement group gave us 3 days to do all of the work on it. And that included two overnights. So we had to go overnight. We had to take about 2 hours to get it out of the case. We had to get contractors in to build scaffolding around it. And then we dismounted the whole thing and we finished about 3 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
And then we put it all in the marine invertebrates gallery. And then which has a big open space in the middle. And we 3D scanned it for 3 days in front of the public. So we answered loads of questions about what we were doing. It was great, actually, you know, as a piece of kind of public engagement and science communication tool, because we could explain what we were doing. It was our science in action, really. And then at the end of it, we had to put it all back together overnight again with the contractors building the scaffolding, because we had to shut the case, you see, in the day. So we had to get it all done overnight. So, yeah, we were absolutely exhausted by the end of it. But, yeah, we have now got a lovely 3D model of the specimen. So we don't need to get it out again. So we can look at it in computationally instead.
Awesome.
No more overnights.
No more overnights. Well, till next time.
I assumed all the ones that were hanging in, because they have those, like you said, those 3D models or maybe casts sort of hanging from the rafters in the dinosaur hall. Are any of the other ones original fossils up there? Or are they all casts at this point?
There is an original Triceratops skull up there. Mm. I'm also getting that down for one of my PhD students, which is causing stress for some people.
Heavy.
They are heavy. And presumably very dusty right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, I have a feeling there's a sauropodomorph, I forget, I think it might be Massospondylus up there.
Oh,
that might have some real material in as well, but I'm not totally sure, actually. The gallery's well before my time at the museum. So.
Yeah, my favorite thing was, and I can't remember which ankylosaur it is, sort of on the back, at almost the very end, there's that really beautiful ankylosaur. You can see all the skin and all that stuff going on.
Yeah, it's Scolosaurus. It's an amazing specimen. It's it's from Alberta, Late Cretaceous, and it's all got all its dermal armor in place, and it's actually, it doesn't have a skull, but the rest of the body is basically completely articulated, and it's been prepared from both sides, so you can walk around and you can see its limbs kind of crouched underneath it. So it's a really, really cool specimen.
Yeah, that thing is awesome. Mm-hmm. That's one that also people miss, because compared to one that's prepped out and sort of reconstructed in 3D, you look at it and you're like, what is that? I don't know. And keep moving.
Yeah. Well, I hope when we get to redevelop the gallery, we'll be able to bring some of those specimens to life a little bit more, maybe do a little bit more interpretation around them and kind of have a little bit more focus on these incredible fossils rather than, the casts and the fake stuff, really.
Yeah.
Is there a timeline for rebuilding the gallery or being worked out?
We're hoping to do it in the next 10 years. It's quite a big job, as you can imagine. And the museum has lots of ambitions to redevelop quite a lot in that time. So, but hopefully in 10 years' time, it will be all shiny and beautiful.
Cool. I think you mentioned that we know that there are some really old stegosaurs, relatively, a lot of people's favorite dinosaurs are from the Cretaceous, but stegosaurs are actually from the Jurassic, even though everyone thinks all the dinosaurs are from the Jurassic.
Thanks, Jurassic Park.
Yeah, right. So there are some cool stegosaurs in Morocco, too. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe a favorite from there or how you started working in Morocco?
Yes, this was... Again, I mean, so much of what we do is opportunistic. Mm-hmm. Things kind of fall in your lap and work programs develop from there. But the specimen was for sale. It was on the commercial market. And I'd actually been sent images of a limb bone from a colleague. And they were for sale from a Moroccan fossil dealer who was selling them as sauropod bones. And I looked at it and I was like, well, that's definitely a stegosaur. My friend sent it to me because he thought it was a stegosaur as well. And I wasn't working at the Natural History Museum at the time. I was elsewhere. And I was thinking, it'd be great if maybe I can get this. I don't know. I'll see. And then about a day later, Paul Barrett, who's the dinosaur researcher at the Natural History Museum and has worked there for many, many years, he sent me the same pictures and said, I'm going to try and acquire this specimen. Oh. So I was like, yay, great news. So we acquired the specimen and then I started working there shortly afterwards.
Oh, good.
And then I wanted to try and track down where it was from, because obviously when we buy things, we do acquire lots of material through purchasing. But when we buy things, we lose the contextual information. So we don't have that information of how the specimen lay in the ground. So was it in an articulated state? Were the bones separated by different layers? Was it a single individual? What environment did it live in? What environment did it die in? And how old is it? And we kind of had lost all of that information. Now, the dealer could tell us where it was from roughly, as in the town or the name of the area. So I started to do some research through literature. And I found that there's long been reports of sauropods in the middle Jurassic of Morocco, in the middle Atlas Mountains, from a set of beds called the Couche Rouge, the red beds. These are well known. And I started to look through these reports to see, I thought, maybe the stegosaurs from these same localities. And then I found a description of a site in a really obscure paper from 1992, written in French by some sedimentologists. And they were looking at palynomorphs or something, micro fossils or something there. And they just noted the presence of some dinosaur bones there. But it seemed to be like the most likely locality where the specimen came from, or that broad area. So I got in touch with a colleague in Morocco who's a sedimentologist. He was able to put me in touch with another sedimentologist who had done his PhD on the area and who's an expert in the rocks of this area. And so I started working with him, with Driss. I went out to Morocco and met up with Driss, and he was able to take me and show me some of the rocks in the area and tell me all about them. And we then went to see the original fossil dealer, who said, yeah, I bought it from my cousin. So I went to see his cousin and he said, okay, I'll meet you tomorrow and we'll drive to the town where I got it. So we drove to the town and we met, I guess, the guy who was kind of in charge of the village. And he said, yes, the site where that specimen's from is about half an hour's drive away, kind of off road. And so we went down there and we came to basically a guy's house, very, very small house. There's no access road, just He's got a donkey in a field next door. And I mean, all of these people, every single time we went and met somebody, everybody gave us tea and sat us down and gave us food. And they were so welcoming. It was so lovely. I was having that. The tea is so strong. It's got so much caffeine in. I was actually having heart palpitations, like genuinely. I kept going like, oh, I think I'm not very well. And then somebody said, it's the caffeine. And I was like, oh.
After your fourth tea of the morning.
Oh God, yeah, really sweet. So much sugar, so much caffeine. Oh my God. But anyway, we went and actually we met the guy who actually digs the fossils out, and he was really nice. He's called Moha, and he showed us all around the site and showed us where he found some fossils. And he showed me all of the, you know, some recent excavations where, you know, there were kind of holes in the ground where he was digging stuff out. I kind of understood what was going on because my French is not very good. And Saeed, who was the cousin of the dealer who was accompanying me, he didn't speak English, but he speaks French. And of course, Moha speaks Berber. So Moha was speaking Berber to Saeed, who was then translating it into French for me. And I was then like trying to translate what he was saying with my high school French. So most of it, I think I got to the bottom of, but
nice.
Not necessarily all of it. But anyway, I was able to go back the next day and really record the sedimentology in a lot of detail and look at the rocks in a lot of detail and understand where these specimens were coming from, which was really fab. And then Driss, who wasn't able to come with us that day, he was then able to go back, and he's been back several times subsequently and has been able to look at the sedimentology himself, you know, much more experienced set of eyes than I have. So it was really good. So we were able to locate this site. I was talking about the specimen originally, though. So that the specimen is just it's an upper arm bone and some backbone, some vertebrae, and that's all we have of it. That's all there is. But it's very clearly a stegosaur. Happily, both the upper arm bone and the vertebrae are very, very distinctive in stegosaurs. So we definitely knew they were stegosaurs, and they were very clearly different from other stegosaurs that we have, particularly the vertebrae. They've got lots of characters in that allow us to tell what species it is. So they're very different from the other stegosaurs that we know. And there's actually only two other stegosaurs from Africa, and both are from Southern Africa. So, I mean, I guess I didn't really expect it to be the same as one of those. Also, it's much older. It's from the Bathonian. It's about 167 million years old. Mm. So, really quite the oldest stegosaur that we have, probably. Yeah, so Driss and I put together a memorandum of understanding so that our two institutions can work together. And one of his students is coming to work with me over the summer, which will be great. I haven't been able to get back to Morocco. The borders are currently closed since then. I had planned to go every year, but haven't made it back. So hopefully this year we'll get back. We hope to work with Moha, who digs the actual bones. And what I'd really like to get him to do is, rather than digging the bones for the commercial dealers, is to dig the bones for us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But rather than dig them up, kind of leave them in the ground so he can find them and sort of tell us where they are, and then we can go excavate them. And although the specimen that we found, that we named Adraticulate, that actually is at the Natural History Museum, all of the rest of the specimens we hope that we find at this site that we'll keep in Morocco. So they're building a new facility at the university in Fez to store the materials. So that's
awesome.
Really cool as well.
I guess the other one that I really want to talk about is, I might butcher the pronunciation of this, but Spicomelis. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Spicomelis. Yes, it doesn't mind.
Yeah.
That's from the same site. So this, what happened with that one was, same commercial dealer had this specimen for sale. And when I saw it, I thought, oh, it's from the same site. So it's probably part of the stegosaur. I said, right, well, let's acquire it and see whether it's part of the same animal. So we acquired it. And when we got it, it was very clear straight off that I didn't know what it was. it was very, very strange. It was this strange, it looked like a rib, but it had these spikes coming out of it. So the spikes, that's fine. I mean, we know that stegosaurs have kind of bizarre armor. We don't have any other stegosaur with spikes like that. But I thought, well, you know, this is a very early stegosaur. We know that stegosaurs, probably the very earliest stegosaurs, things like Hawaiianosaurus, which is one of the most earliest stegosaurs, actually has more armor, actually has scutes on its back as well as those plates down its spine. And stegosaurs probably reduced their dermal armor to just those plates during their evolution. Mm. So I thought, well, you know, maybe these early stegosaurs have, you know, they have something different. They have more armor or something. So, you know, okay, well, maybe it's a stegosaur. But this thing did look like a rib. And we decided, how are we going to solve this problem of what this thing is? So we decided to do some histological sampling. So we decided to slice up the rib bit and one of the spikes. And the armor has quite distinctive characteristics histologically. So when you look at it down a microscope, when you look at the bone tissue, it's quite distinctive. And we had some comparisons in the literature and actually within our own collection to compare it with. And I also cut up a rib from another ankylosaur that we had in the collection as well. And we had other stegosaur examples to compare it with. So we looked at these and we very clearly, quite early on, figured that it was, it really definitely was a rib. It definitely really looked like a rib. But more than that it had this really unique type of bone that only ankylosaurs have, at least in the Jurassic, only ankylosaurs have. So we have some sauropods that have it in the Cretaceous, and we have some other things like etosaurs that have it way back in the Triassic. But in the Jurassic, the only animals that have this sort of texture that were alive were the ankylosaurs. So that was a real surprise, because the hitherto oldest ankylosaur was only a little bit younger, actually. And it's also from the UK. It's from the Colovian, so it's also Middle Jurassic, but kind of really late in the Middle Jurassic. And this is older, but we know, after that, and that's represented by just a little part of a lower jaw. And that's the only thing we have from that ankylosaur. But then we know ankylosaurs much better once we get into the Upper Jurassic, and of course up into the Cretaceous. They're a really kind of important part of ecosystems, at least in North America and Asia. So it was quite surprising to see it in the Middle Jurassic, but we would expect it there because we have stegosaurs there, and stegosaurs and ankylosaurs are sister taxa. They're most closely related to each other. So if the stegosaurs are there, the ankylosaurs must have been around. Mm. We just haven't found them yet. So, they are, we would expect them to be there. So although it was unexpected, I mean, it was kind of unexpected, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Maybe don't. Anyway, it was very, very cool. And it's just totally unlike anything else that we have in the fossil record or indeed alive today, because it has their armor, but rather than just being embedded in the skin, they're actually fused to the ribs. If you think about your own rib cage, you've got muscles that run across your ribs and they help to move your arms forward and stuff. I have no idea how this animal would have walked. I mean, where did its arm muscles go? I don't know. It's just bizarre. So it's genuinely weird and I don't really understand it. So we definitely need to go back to find some more of that thing.
Oh, I hope you find all of it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that is the craziest thing. When I saw that too, I had the exact same thought you did, which is like, hey, it looks kind of like a thagomizer or something. You know, it's spiky like it. And I saw your name was on it too. And I was like, oh, it must be a stegosaur, obviously. Then it's like, oh no, it's an ankylosaur. What is happening? And for it to come from the same quarry as a stegosaur too, on top of that, really makes it weird.
Yeah. But we do have stegosaurs and ankylosaurs living alongside each other in ecosystems throughout the Jurassic. Hmm. So I mentioned this other ankylosaur from the UK, which is Colovian in age. It's called Sarcolestes. And that's actually from a marine rock called the Oxford Clay. We also have a stegosaur from there. It's called Loracatosaurus. And then when we go up into the Upper Jurassic, of course, we have Stegosaurus living alongside Mimoropelta and Gargoylosaurus in the Morrison Formation. And also the same in Portugal, we have Dracopelta and Mirogaia living alongside each other. So we actually do have in the Middle Jurassic stegosaurs and ankylosaurs, which appear to have been co-occurring in these Jurassic ecosystems. So, maybe it's not so surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a proposed, this might be getting out of your wheelhouse a little bit, but I know sometimes, say with like hadrosaurs, they'll be like, oh, these ones were browsers and these ones were grazers and this is how they lived together. Is there any sort of idea about how they niche partitioned between stegosaurs and ankylosaurs?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for the Cretaceous ankylosaurs, we know that they have quite a lot of ability to move their jaws. They can rotate their jaws quite a lot. They were clearly processing food in their mouth. They have wear facets on their teeth. We don't really see that in stegosaurs. Now, of course, when we go back to the Jurassic ankylosaurs, they're so fragmentary. At least the Middle Jurassic ones, we really don't have that information. And I'm not sure that work has really been carried out on things like Mimoropelta and Gargoylosaurus from the Morrison. So part of the problem with that is that we don't really have the specimens. And there's actually only three stegosaurs in the world for which we have complete skulls. Mm. So it makes things quite difficult because we don't have teeth. We don't have heads for a lot of these animals. But there is certainly, based on later ankylosaurs, this evidence that they were doing a lot more food processing in their mouths, whereas stegosaurs were probably cropping with a horny beak or something like that. So I think they probably must have been niche partitioning in some way.
Cool. Yeah, that's always weird when you see things that superficially look similar, but then you look a little closer and you can see the differences.
Mm-hmm. I guess going to Stegosaurus specifically, I know there's you've done a lot of work on the skeleton and body mass and all kinds of stuff around Stegosaurus. So Like, what made it so special or different from other types of stegosaurs?
Stegosaurus actually is quite unusual. Although it's our sort of, we think of it as our kind of archetypical stegosaur, if you like. You know, it's the thing that everybody knows. It's actually a little bit weird compared to other stegosaurs. Its plates are quite weird. So it has these very, very, very large, very, very, very flat, they're very, very thin plates. And most stegosaurs don't have that. Most stegosaurs' plates are much smaller. Hmm. So they're probably only 15 to 20 centimeters in size. Whereas Stegosaurus's plates, I mean, I've seen a Stegosaurus plate that's a meter in size. You know, they're very large, some of these things. And many stegosaurs actually have quite spine-like armor. So they're sort of spines that have then got elongated edges to give them a kind of triangular shape. We think, although we don't know because we don't have, they're not that well preserved, that pretty much most other stegosaurs had paired dermal armor down their back. So the plates were in pairs, whereas in Stegosaurus, they appear to have been offset from each other. So the plates aren't paired down the back. And quite a lot of other stegosaurs also have spines. They have other armor as well as the row of plates down their back. So they have spines on their shoulders. And we don't see that in Stegosaurus either. So Stegosaurus it's a little bit weird. It also has quite short forelimbs relative to its hind limbs. And yeah, it is a little bit unusual, actually.
It's always funny when the one that's the namesake for like the whole group is sort of an outlier.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, the really famous stegosaur at the British...
Sophie?
Yeah, Sophie. Sophie is very famous. We had a listener ask, should it have a different place in the museum or do you like where it is in the, I think it's called the Hall of Earth History or something like that?
Yeah, well, it's one of our entrances. So there's two entrances to the museum. And so the visitors that come in that entrance, that's the first thing they see. So I quite like that. I think that's quite cool. And I also I really like the mount. It's a really dynamic kind of mount. I don't know whether it will be there forever. I suspect when we do redevelop the dinosaur gallery, it might well get moved, but I don't know yet. But no, I quite like where it is at the moment because people sort of walk in and they walk up the steps and it's there facing them and it's really beautifully lit up. And yeah, I think it's great. I think it's a great display. And I love the fact that we have all of the real material on display with the exception of the skull. But Sophie's, it's a really, really, really significant and important specimen. It's the most complete Stegosaurus ever found. So there were just really basic things about stegosaurs that we didn't know until we had Sophie. So for example, we didn't know how many backbones there were. We didn't know how many vertebrae there were in the back. We didn't know how long the tail was, we didn't have vertebrae there were in the tail because we didn't have a complete articulated skeleton. So, you know, again, Stegosaurus is this incredibly iconic dinosaur that every seven-year-old knows. But actually how much we know about it from a scientific point of view isn't as much as you might expect given its popular, you know, appeal, its iconic status. So yeah, we didn't know how many backbones there were. We didn't know how many plates and spines there were along the back. We only had two other complete skulls, but in both of those specimens, the skulls are fused into a single block. So all the bones are fused together. So whilst that's nice, they're both quite squished as well. While that's quite nice to be able to kind of, you know, hold the skull and go, wow, look, it's a stegosaur head. From an anatomical point of view, there's not that much information you can get out of it because all of the, you know, the jaws are fused shut in both of them. So you can't see the palate. You know, there's lots of details of the brain case that are missing. We can't see the shapes of individual bones and understand how the bones kind of join together. And one of the great things about Sophie is that it has a complete disarticulated skull. So all of the skull bones were separate. So that allowed us really for the first time to understand what Stegosaurus's skull looked like. So Stegosaurus, when you look back at kind of old reconstructions, they have these rather long, low snouted skulls. Mm-hmm. And when we got Sophie, my colleague CT scanned it and then digitally reconstructed the skull and built the skull, an undistorted Stegosaurus skull for the first time. And it turns out that kind of long, low snout is just crushing of those specimens. And actually they had a much more kind of basal ornithischian type skull than we had realized before. So there's loads of just really basic stuff that we didn't know. And so we decided when we first got the specimen that we were going to write a monograph on Stegosaurus and just describe its anatomy because that hadn't been done for 100 years.
Wow.
So we published the paper in 2015 and the last time Stegosaurus was described was in 1915. So it's amazing, you know, and in the light of all of that knowledge and all of those new discoveries that have been found since 1915 and, you know, Stegosaurus hadn't been described. So yeah, there's a lot to know. And of course, once you have a really complete skeleton, you can do all sorts of cool stuff with it. We had a postdoc work on the project. So again, the specimen was on the commercial market. We bought it And we can't usually afford to buy complete articulated skeletons. Yeah. So it was thanks to a very large private donation, which was extremely generous. But not only did that pay for the skeleton, but it also paid for the scientific study of it. So a postdoc was employed by the museum for a year to study the specimen, which was fantastic. And the postdoc, Charlotte, she took over 20,000 individual photographs of the bones. Wow. And made photogrammetric models of all of the elements. So we have this really rather beautiful 3D model as well, which is fabulous because, again, the specimen's on display, but I can share that model with researchers all around the world who want to use it. But it allowed us then to do really cool things like look at the body mass of Stegosaurus computationally, properly. It allowed us to look at walking and limb bone motions. The skull, my colleagues did some really cool bite force work on the skull and look at how much, what Stegosaurus's bite force was. I still would what I really want to do is test this idea that Stegosaurus was using its plates as radiators, as a thermoregulatory device. So what I'd really like to do is we've got the 3D array of plates digitally, and I want to kind of use computational fluid dynamics to examine the heat loss across the plates. We did have a go at it, but it didn't work very well. But I think that was a while ago, and I think we can probably do a bit better than that now. I think, you know, computationally, we've moved on a little bit. So that's something that I'm still kind of, you know, hankering after doing the specimen.
Yeah. There's got to be some reason for those plates to be so large.
Yeah.
Is that one of your favorite reasons or maybe preferred hypotheses for the plates is the thermoregulation?
Yeah, I don't think it's why they evolved, probably. I suspect that they were probably, you know, originally that certainly in basal ornithischian, in basal diarrheophorans, and then probably in basal stegosaurs, they probably were armor, genuinely, you know, they were there to protect the back of the animal from predators. Because in these others, as I have already explained, some of the plates are quite a different shape. They're quite small. They're not particularly plate-like. They're much more spike-like. Whereas in Stegosaurus, they're just greatly hypertrophied. So I suspect that thermoregulation wasn't the reason they evolved, but potentially in Stegosaurus, I can see that they might have been co-opted for that sort of purpose. And, you know, I think if you have something that large on your back, I mean, you're going to lose heat out of it. You just are, aren't you? We know that crocodilian scutes, even those tiny little scutes compared to Stegosaurus, at least that crocs have in their skins, they actually lose heat out of those. So, you know, thyrophorans must have lost heat out of their plates to some extent. So, yeah, I think it's totally plausible. And I also, you know, I don't think Stegosaurus's plates would have been much good as actual defensive structures because they're very, very thin. And yeah, they would have been covered in some sort of horny kind of keratinous covering, but they were still very thin. And I think, you know, if you're Allosaurus living alongside Stegosaurus in the Morrison Formation, it'd be like eating a pack of Doritos or something, wouldn't it? You'd be chomping through these plates. I just doesn't strike me as a particularly useful form of armor. I think one of the things that I have seen though is that lots of the different stegosaurs have different shape plates. So I do wonder whether there's some sort of interspecific or intraspecific kind of signaling display thing going on there as well. Unfortunately, we just don't have the specimens to be able to really test those ideas right now.
Yeah. If the plates weren't useful for defense, do you think the thagomizer, like in terms of a Allosaurus trying to eat a stegosaurus, what would be its best defense? Because it's not going to be able to run away from Allosaurus.
No. There was no running going on in Stegosaurus's life, is it? Yeah, I think the tail was probably a genuine weapon. And there has been some work that's been done on, you know, what was the impact at the end? What was the force that a tail spike would have impacted into an Allosaurus's leg or something like that? And yeah, it's been shown that it could have kind of crushed bone even or impacted into the bone. And there is a really cool fossil that is an Allosaurus back vertebra. And it's got a pathology in it, where you've got a kind of hole in one of the processes that comes off the vertebrae and somebody has stuck a Stegosaurus spike in and it kind of fits perfectly in this hole. So potentially it could be that, you know, this Allosaur had a bit of Stegosaurus tail spike broken off in its back and the bone actually healed around this spike. So yeah, I think we have some circumstantial evidence perhaps that Stegosaurus was actually doing that to Allosaurus.
That only needs to happen once to that Allosaurus, and it's probably not going after any more Stegosaurus.
Yeah. Go after one of those rubbish Camptosauruses or something after that.
Yeah. Something without huge spikes. So you talked a little bit about this, but how a Stegosaurus has glide symmetry of the plates, I guess, meaning that they're alternating, you know, rather than paired. Do you have any guess about why they might have had that weird non-bilateral symmetry going on?
Not really, no. It's an excellent question. Yeah, it definitely is a thing. It definitely is a feature. We have a couple of fossils preserved where they're definitely offset from each other and the plates are not pairs. We definitely know that. So yeah, they are definitely offset from each other. Why? I don't know. I mean, if it is a thermoregulatory structure, then maybe they work better when they're offset from each other. Maybe that's something I could test in my computational fluid dynamics, whether they work better when they're offset from each other. It could be a display thing. As I say, I think these things were potentially signaling to each other intraspecifically or whatever using plates. But no, I don't know. I have no idea. It's not a very good answer, sorry.
I mean, like almost every animal is, or every vertebrate at least, is bilaterally symmetric with a few exceptions. It's just so strange that that one isn't.
Yeah, it is very weird actually, yeah.
Just add to the list of what makes Stegosaurus so different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, then for our listeners, if they want to keep up with what you're working on or, you know, the maybe upcoming renovations of the museum or really anything else that you want to point to online, is there anywhere you'd like to send people?
Yeah, you can check out the Natural History Museum's dinosaur website. It has all our news stories on. It has loads of updates and kind of stories about recent research and things that's going on, not just from us, but from other people as well. It also, if you have kids, it's got loads of quizzes and, you know, games and puzzles and things to do with dinosaurs. And that's nhm.ac.uk/discover/dinosaurs. And you can follow me on Twitter at Tweetysaurus.
Excellent. That's a fantastic handle too.
Yeah.
I got in there early on Twitter to get that one, you see.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks again, Susanna. It has been a long time coming, this interview. And we really appreciate you setting us straight on all the Stegosaurus questions that we had.
Oh, yeah. Stegosaurs are so cool.
And shortly, we're going to get on to our dinosaur of the day, Mercuryceratops. But first, we're going to pause for a quick sponsor break. The Morrison Formation is by far the most famous Jurassic site in the United States, and I would argue in the world.
Especially for sauropods.
It does have some fantastic sauropods. They are spread across multiple states, and the Morrison Formation covers a good portion of western Colorado, and that's where this week's sponsor, the Colorado Northwestern Community College, or CNCC, comes in. Possibly the most famous sauropod from the Morrison Formation is Brachiosaurus, and the Morrison Formation also includes two other very famous dinosaurs, Allosaurus and Stegosaurus, and CNCC actually has an active dig site right now with all three of those amazing dinosaurs in one site.
Nice. And even better, you can join them digging up those bones this summer. They're offering 16-day field programs where you can dig up bones with expert local paleontologists from the college. There's two scheduled digs. The first one's July 6th to July 20th. The second one is July 22nd to August 5th. But they are filling up, so be sure that you sign up now. You can go to cncc.edu/dinodig to get all the details. Make sure you register online by May 31st, but do it even sooner because, again, those spots are going to be full soon. Again, that's cncc.edu/dinodig. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, world-class language learning for the world's best moms. It's almost Mother's Day, after all. We're going to continue our story from last time about our trip to the Taipei Zoo in Taiwan.
Yeah, we definitely recommend the Taipei Zoo in Taiwan. They have a really cool dinosaur museum featuring all the highlights like Deinonychus, T-Rex, Triceratops.
So we had a really great time. And then we decided to take the train back and we had some more aha moments with our language learning journey.
Yeah, we had to read some maps to navigate home. And of course, a lot of the things are translated into English, but not everything is translated. So it helps a lot if you know some of the local language. It's also very nice to be able to understand announcements when you're on public transportation.
Yes, because things can change sometimes. And as a bonus, we were on the train at the time when everyone was coming home from work, so I got to practice even more by listening in on conversations. Not that I was trying, but we were elbow to elbow with people, so it was hard not to hear what they were saying. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything too juicy, mostly people talking about what they're going to have for dinner. But a lot of the early phrases I learned in Chinese had to do with food, so I felt pretty good about what I could understand. And Rosetta Stone can help you have your own proud moments.
Yes, and the lessons are short, so you can fit them into your busy schedule. And for a limited time, you can get all of Rosetta Stone's 25 language courses for just $179, which is a huge discount off of the usual $399. And you can do that at rosettastone.com/dino. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Mercuryceratops, which was a request from Crow via our Patreon and Discord, so thanks. It was a chasmosaurine ceratopsid that lived in the late Cretaceous in what is now Alberta, Canada, in the Dinosaur Park Formation, and in Montana in the U.S. in the Judith River Formation. It looked like other ceratopsians. It walked on all fours, it had a large frill, it also had brow horns and a beak. It's estimated to be around the same size as Chasmosaurus. That's about 14 to 15.7 feet or 4.3 to 4.8 meters long.
Yeah, so like medium-sized?
Yeah. And as a chasmosaurine, it probably had two long brow horns and a short nose horn.
Like Triceratops.
Yes. As a quick reminder, there's two main groups of ceratopsians. There's chasmosaurs. Those are the ones that generally had the long neck frills, the short nasal horns, and the large brow horns. And centrosaurians. Those are the ones that generally had short frills, large nasal horns, and short brow horns.
I always think of Styracosaurus as the prototypical centrosaurine with the big decorative frill, and then Triceratops as the chasmosaur.
Those are some good examples.
That's how I remember it. So this is a Triceratops-like one, not a Styracosaurus-like one. But there are weird crossovers. It was good that you said generally, because it's not always the case.
Just like everything with dinosaurs.
Yep, it gets messy sometimes.
Mercuryceratops was herbivorous. It probably had a parrot-like beak. And it helps to show more variation in ceratopsid frills and skull ornamentation. That's because it had a unique frill with wing-like protrusions on the sides of the frill. They've been described as a butterfly-shaped frill or neck shield.
Oh, I have seen that. As soon as you describe that, I can imagine what it looks like.
Well, they've also been described as like the decorative fins on classic 1950s cars.
That's interesting.
The squamosal skull bones were hatchet-shaped and they stuck out from the side. And this skull ornamentation was probably used to identify each other and attract mates, in addition to maybe defense. The type species is Mercuryceratops gemini.
It's such an astrological type name.
It is. The genus name means Mercury horned face. It refers to the Roman god Mercury because of the wing-like ornamentation on its head being similar to the winged helmet.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. And the species name refers to the constellation Gemini, their name for the twins Castor and Pollux, because two very similar Mercuryceratops specimens were found, one in Canada and one in the U.S. It was described in 2014 by Michael Ryan and others, and the fossils were first found in 2007 by Tribal Paleontology. They found the frill elements. So those two specimens that were found were nearly identical, the one in Canada and the one in the U.S., they found the squamosals from the right side of the skull. And that helps to show that these fossils were probably not distorted or crushed or that it wasn't a pathology.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's always the question, right? When you find a weird dinosaur, like, was it weird or did it just have some issue or did it get distorted or what happened here?
And this one was weird.
Yeah. When you find two, that is excellent evidence.
These specimens were found about 236 miles or 380 kilometers from each other. Just fairly far apart.
Mm-hmm.
The fossils in Montana were collected on private land and acquired by the Royal Ontario Museum, and the fossils from Canada were collected by Susan Owen Kagan from the University of Alberta.
So now they're both in Canada.
Mm-hmm. The holotype of Mercuryceratops may be a subadult, and then the referred specimen is a little bit larger, so it might be older. Mercuryceratops is part of the Southern Alberta Dinosaur Project, which focuses on dinosaurs from the late Cretaceous found in Alberta and Montana. It's a perfect fit. Mercuryceratops represents the oldest known chasmosaurine from Canada found at the time and, quote, the first pre-Maastrichtian ceratopsid to have been collected on both sides of the Canada-U.S. border.
It's a fun little tidbit.
Mm-hmm. Now, other animals that lived around the same time and place as Mercuryceratops include ceratopsids, amphibians, fish, crocodilians, and lizards.
And our fun fact of the day is that Stegosaurus was the second Ornithischian ever animated.
Is that after Gertie?
Gertie is not an Ornithischian.
Oh, you're right. Gertie's a sauropod. I should not have said that.
A type of Soroski. Well, you are right. There, in that there have been tons of sauropods animated, and I think there were probably 3 or 4 sauropods animated before Stegosaurus. So you're on the right track. But can you guess what the first ever Ornithischian animated was?
Triceratops.
Yep, you got it.
Once I remembered what an Ornithischian was, I got there.
Yeah. A lot of times people do summarize Ornithischians as like the plant-eating dinosaurs, which is an oversimplification because they weren't all plant eaters. And on top of that, sauropods mostly ate plants.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly...
Also, I've got a bias, so I'm always just thinking of the sauropods.
Yeah, that's true. So the first Triceratops animated was the Triceratops in The Ghost of Slumber Mountain from 1918. I have seen this animation before, but I hadn't watched the whole video. I watched it just preparing for this fun fact when I was fact-checking myself. It was animated by Willis O'Brien.
Of course.
Who did a lot of these early animations. And it's like a guy dreaming, and he dreams a T-Rex fighting a Triceratops. And then he wakes up and he thinks he needs to be like running away. It's a silent film. So he's like, gets up all freaked out, and somebody next to him is like, calm down. You were just dreaming. And there's like a whole story about somebody following a ghost. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I think part of the film, it was originally 40 or 50 minutes long, and there's only like 20 minutes of it remaining. So I think part of it has been lost because old film is very flammable and also deteriorates. So it's over 100 years old. You could see why we don't have the whole thing anymore.
That's too bad. A lot of work probably went into it.
Yeah, but I think it has the whole part that includes dinosaurs.
Oh, okay,
because I
good.
Think that would be in the dream part. So I think we got the best part. Then 7 years later, in 1925, O'Brien animated The Lost World. It included Triceratops fighting T-Rex / Allosaurus again, but it also included Edmontosaurus and Stegosaurus, which are 2 more Ornithischians.
Mm-hmm.
So Edmontosaurus and Stegosaurus are basically tied for second in the animated Ornithischian realm, but I really wanted to parse out which one came first. And in my digging, I found that 3 years before The Lost World was released, O'Brien's animation of Stegosaurus had already been showed to the public. This is a crazy story.
Okay.
So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote the novel The Lost World, which was released in 1912.
Mm-hmm.
And by this point, 3 years before The Lost World movie came out, O'Brien was already working on animating it. And since Arthur Conan Doyle also appeared at the beginning of the film, he was obviously pretty involved in the process and must have known Willis O'Brien. Actually, you can see the new version of Arthur Conan Doyle at the beginning of the film. It was lost for a while. We actually saw it a few years ago, remember, at the Silent Film Festival?
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool. It reminds me a little bit of like Princess Bride or something, where the guy's reading a book and then it sort of like cuts back. But Arthur Conan Doyle was also friends with Harry Houdini. It's a whole other story.
Mm-hmm.
But Arthur Conan Doyle reportedly showed a reel of Willis O'Brien's animations, including multiple dinosaurs, to a meeting of the Society of American Magicians. And this was in 1922. So he presented them as psychic and imaginative creations.
Okay.
But wouldn't answer any questions about their origin. So the obvious implication was that the 1912 novel was actually based on reality. Apparently, people didn't know that there was a movie being created about it yet and weren't familiar with Willis O'Brien's animation style, because a lot of them believed that this was a real thing, or that it could have been a real thing, like a real recording of actual animals. The exact film clip that was shared isn't clear to me. I couldn't find any reference to, you know, here's the clip or any video of it. Some places claim that it was Triceratops, Allosaurus, and Stegosaurus, but I couldn't validate that anywhere. The only place I could find that really went into detail about it was the New York Times article from 1922, which is really fantastic. So what they said was, quote, monsters of several million years ago, mostly of the dinosaur species, made love and killed each other in Sir Arthur's pictures. Prehistoric brutes that resemble rhinoceros, magnified many times, equipped with enormous horns that pointed forward like those of the unicorn, drove dinosaurs away from feasts on one another. One monster, like a horned toad of monumental proportions, presented an impenetrable surface of armor plate to attacking reptiles and moved along in safety.
Wow.
Is a very fantastical description of dinosaurs.
Yes.
So presumably the enormous unicorn was a Triceratops and the monumental horned toad was a Stegosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the final version of The Lost World, you see a Triceratops fight a T-Rex. So that must be what they were talking about there. And there is a Stegosaurus, which basically gets left alone, which is basically the description. There wasn't any mention of Edmontosaurus. It could have been in the mix, but it didn't get included in the only description I could find. The New York Times also said, quote, if fakes, they were masterpieces. Which, Willis O'Brien was a fantastic animator, but from a modern perspective, it's pretty hilarious that anyone thought that these things were real.
Yeah, but if you think about people back in the day and film is fairly new as a medium.
It's true, yeah. I think that's probably how it always goes.
Mm-hmm.
If you go 100 years into the future, they would probably create things that we would say are real, and they'd be like, well, obviously that's fake.
Yeah, I could see that happening with VR.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my evidence that Stegosaurus was the second Ornithischian ever animated, which is pretty cool because we have so few fossils of it. It's just such a really interesting animal with those crazy plates.
Mm-hmm.
How could you not want to animate it and see what it would have looked like in real life?
It's one of the first dinosaurs I drew as a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's really special.
And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thank you for listening. If you haven't done so yet, consider joining our dinosaur enthusiast community at patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.